My name is Brandy Bugney. I work with the Michigan Department of Education. I'm the literacy manager there. I'll have my my colleagues introduce themselves. Jim, you're next on the screen. So,
hi, I'm Jim Pellegrino from the University of Illinois in Chicago. I'm the guy they imported into Michigan to help with this.
My name's Dr. Adria Trucken-Miller. I'm an assistant professor of special education at Michigan State University.
Hi, I'm Insu Cho, and I'm also assistant professor at Michigan State University.
And now we're all best friends, and I'll keep roping them in to the great work that we need to do in our state. So welcome to our session. We hope to accomplish these goals in this short time. We want to provide an explanation of the project. You heard a little bit this morning. We'll give you a little more insight. We want to look at a small portion of the guidance with you so that you can further understand all of the depths and deep spots of literacy or of assessment that you already know and how it connects to literacy. And we want to be able to provide some guidance on making wise decisions about the assessments schools need to really support literacy achievement, that assessment for learning, if you will. So those are the goals. If that's not what you were looking for, it's not the right place. All right, so this project, I am gonna use these talking points. Literacy rates should be better. Jim mentioned that this morning. They should be better in Michigan. We do feel like there's a bit of a crisis in terms of our scores across the board. They're flat, just like the nation. We're not super worse off than other states, but we know it's not as good as it should be. We have an excellent foundation and momentum around literacy. If you've heard about the early literacy essentials in our state, if you've heard about all the legislation that does also incorporate some funding around early literacy, we're just in a space to really leverage what's happening for our students around literacy. We do know that there is a lack of understanding of the role of assessment, period, and then definitely a lack of the role of assessment for literacy's sake, and that there's a space there that people are ready to really start diving into what can we do around assessment that will ultimately support our kids for literacy's sake. Districts are required by law to implement literacy assessment systems. This is specifically a part of the Read by Grade 3 law. It does touch into some other legislation. What we know is that while the department was supposed to choose three assessment systems for literacy, there is not something you can just go pull off the shelf that gets at all the assessments, specifically the way it's written in the law. We tried to do some things to get to the point where we could help districts understand what assessments are available for what purposes and what they actually assess, but we have really long assessment lists, and that's probably not helping schools to just pick something off of either of those lists. That doesn't make a system, as Jim talked about this morning. And so there's a need for assessment literacy to support educators in understanding how to choose and use assessment systems. So, yay us, Michigan, we've got lots of opportunities. So here's what we decided to do. You know, we had those long lists and we said, this isn't working, who could help us? Well, who better to help the Department of Ed than our key partner, the Michigan Assessment Consortium? So I reached out to Kathy Dewsbury White and we hatched a plan for how we might come together and bring some expertise. And what we wanted to do was two things. Yes, we wanted guidance, but as I said on the slide before, we have a space where we need to develop some assessment literacy for even those people supporting schools. So we wanted to build understanding about early literacy assessments. And we wanted to illustrate how a system of assessments can promote literacy. So Jim showed these slides this morning, so I won't spend a ton of time here, but we know there's expertise on literacy instruction, expertise on systems, and expertise on assessment. Bless you. So we needed to bring experts from all those spaces together, and we needed to have a way for them to think through what it means when these three pieces come together, and we needed somebody to help facilitate that. In comes Jim. What a great choice for us. He was able to really help our group of principal contributors, all of those experts and researchers, two of which are here in the front row with me, to think through how would we provide this guidance. And then we had a responder group, all those first line people that are supporting districts that still need to be brought up with that knowledge of literacy instruction and assessment and how a system comes together. So we had that group that worked on developing the guidance. Here are some of those faces that you heard about this morning. You see some of our friendly experts sitting right here in the room. And we got to the point where we're ready to talk about what the report looks like. So here's where I get to hand it over to Jim.
Thank you. So I mentioned this a little bit, and I'm just going to try to segue into the real substance of the session, and which is to cover a major part of the ideas in the report. But as I mentioned earlier today, we tried to develop this report in a way that hopefully is useful and usable to a variety of audiences. So the report has these five sections. The first section is a sort of brief introduction that lays out the challenge that exists right now, as Brandy indicated. What's the purpose of the guide? What are our critical assumptions, et cetera? And then I would sort of say the piece that we are expecting many people to look at is section one, in which we tried to condense into one section, okay, what are the important ideas here that we're trying to offer about the early literacy assessment system and its development? And so it includes the five principles that I mentioned earlier, one of which we're really going to talk about in depth today, and how to what's the backing for that, as well as the sets of recommendations that we are making for each of these three phases. Because building an assessment system is going to take time, it's going to take effort, and we've sort of tried to think about this in sort of providing guidance to sort of say, okay, what are the three phases? Well, one of them is planning and designing this. Another phase is actually implementing the assessment system. And the third phase is supporting and monitoring it to make sure it's functioning as you intended. So this section of the report tries to just talk about the what. What is this thing? How do you begin to think about it? I also mentioned this second section. When we started, we didn't have the idea of writing this section. But in the process of trying to think through what is an assessment system and how does it work, we developed these portraits of these three young people moving along a trajectory of literacy development, trying to paint a picture of who are we talking about? Who is this system supposed to sort of impact? And how could we envision these three young people and their trajectory over time up through into third grade? Not only their trajectory, but the interactions they have with a variety of people in their lives, in the community, in the classroom, specialists, et cetera. And these portraits, I think, are very revealing in the sense of what they can help people envision about this process of supporting literacy development and the role that assessment can play as part of a system. And we envision this actually as a very valuable professional development resource, and we hope people actually benefit greatly from it. The third part of the report is the long part. Okay. This is the long part where essentially for each of the principles, we have a chapter, a section, in which we lay out the backing for that. What's the research and the thinking behind that principle? And the recommendations that are associated with that, as well as some of the resources about how you implement that principle. How do you do this? What's the real substance? So today, in this session, we're going to focus on what is number four up there, purposes, users, and technical adequacy of the assessment. And lastly, we have a glossary. I mean, it turns out there's lots of terms. There's lots of language in the world of assessment and in the world of literacy. And so we tried to provide a glossary for that. The references for those of you who want to do the backtracking of some of the scholarly backing. And a little bit about some of the other landscape of literacy initiatives in Michigan that support this larger picture. So I'm going to just briefly remind you that what this fourth principle is, and then we're going to dive into that. This is a principle that is in this second phase of implementing an early literacy assessment system. And it's really that the point that, among other things, the early literacy assessment system has to reflect what we know from the assessment literature about the purposes, the users, and the technical adequacy of assessments, particularly as related to components of early literacy. So we want to think about, who are the users? What are the decisions that they oftentimes need to make? What do we mean by technical adequacy? And Unsu and Adria are going to dive into that, among other things, as well as how does this play out in content? Because when we talk about early literacy, we're talking about reading, we're talking about writing, we're talking about speaking, we're talking about listening. So it is a rich domain which has multiple facets to it. We want to emphasize something in terms of a balanced assessment system that includes assessment for learning and assessment of learning. The learning got left off of that slide. I'm not quite sure what happened to it, this version of it. It's assessment for what? but it's supposed to say assessment of learning in the system of assessments. These are sort of the things that are we want to consider. So I'm not going to belabor this. In fact, I'm going to turn this over to Unsu, who's going to dive in and sort of, you know, pick up on sort of where we're going on this tour of the backing for this whole principle. So it's all yours.
So I'm Unsu Cho, and I'm going to co-present with Dr. Adria Truckenmiller about what we're talking about in session 3-4, principle 4. So we identified four things that are important when we're trying to create a system of assessment to really help students move through their advance their literacy skills. And one is the users. There are various stakeholders that are involved in student learning. Not only teachers or interventionists are involved, there's policymakers, families, and administrators are all perform important role in student learning. And most importantly, they make different decisions for the students. Teachers make decisions about how can they modify and adjust instruction, what skills needs to be taught. Administrators make important decisions about who are the students who are at risk for not meeting the state grade level standards and who need additional support. So they make important placement decisions. Families and children themselves make decisions about their own learning and their child's learning and where they're going. And also policymakers make important policy level decisions that really can impact what school districts and administrators and teachers will do day to day. And it's also important to know that what level of evidence to support using the assessment for that particular decisions for these each stakeholders making. And also, we're not talking about this in the absence of the content. So we're talking about all of this within the context of literacy development. So we want to talk about the reading domains being measured and its relationship to overall literacy. So talk about users. So there are various stakeholders that I've briefly mentioned, children and families, classroom teachers, literacy specialists or intervention teachers. There's other specialists like speech language pathologists, school administrators and leadership teams, MTSS team, data team, et cetera. There's also policymakers. So as I said, children and families make important decisions, and they know they use assessment data to see whether they're learning or not, and whether they're progressing towards the goal. Also, classroom teachers make informed decisions using the assessments, using either formal assessments, informal assessments, to really guide their instruction and really understand where the students, whether the students are responding to their instruction or not. Literacy, same with literacy specialists, intervention teachers, and other specialists, they use assessments to really guide their instruction and really identify the area of weaknesses and strength to really support, really leverage their strength and really support, address the weaknesses of each individual student. Administrators and school leadership teams, they often ask questions about like whether their school, how their school is performing, and what, which students and how many students are at risk for not meeting the state level standards. And those type of question really guides important decisions about like resource reallocation and like school students' placement decisions, especially within the multi-tiered system of support, this framework. Also, policymakers make important human resource and financial and educational decisions for that will impact children's learning. And for example, in the state of Florida, there was a legislation that provided free, high-quality, free screening and diagnosis assessment to all kids in Florida. And they sent out highly qualified literacy coaches to each elementary school, and that really strengthened students' achievement, and it really lowered the number of students who are at risk for not meeting the state level, grade level standards. So policymakers also make an important role, perform an important role, and they use assessment data to make those decisions. So talking about decisions, so we have different users and stakeholders ask different questions to make different decisions for children. So in community or families, they ask questions like, how are schools doing in helping their students achieve grade level proficiency standards? And this type of question can be probably answered not through informal like classroom assessments, but through statewide achievement test. School leadership team administrator asks questions something like, how many students and which students have achieved the standards or are at risk for not achieving that standard by the end of the grade, and which students need additional instructional support. So these kind of decisions also may not be made by certain type of assessment that focuses on specific literacy skills, but more of an assessment that assesses broader literacy skills and domains, like state achievement tests or universal screening that's performed school-wide. So those are the assessments that can address those specific questions. Classroom teachers, by contrast, they ask more specific questions about their individual students that they have, that they care for. So what are ongoing needs and interests, strengths of my students? What do students know? How are they learning? And how can I support my students' learning? Those are some questions that teachers ask day to day in their classroom as they interact with their students. How can I group my students based on their interests and learning needs? So these might not be the questions that can be answered through those large-scale assessments, but can be answered through more informal assessments or curriculum embedded assessment that really gives the teacher an idea of whether the students are learning the content that they're actually teaching. In tier two, a literacy specialist or interventionist might ask, what are the specific skills that they need to teach for these group of students? And they might ask, like, are students in tier two intervention making progress towards meeting the grade level standards in response to their instruction? And so those are the questions that interventionists ask in tier two level, and this might be something that curriculum-based measurements like CBM or curriculum-embedded measures, general outcomes measures can address, but not necessarily a large-scale or standardized test can address those. In tier three, special education teachers or interventionists also ask these questions. Does the student, if the student did not respond to tier two generally effective evidence-based instruction, then does the student have learning disabilities in the area related to literacy? And what specific literacy skills does the student need in tier three? And what students, are students in tier three and special education making progress? So again, like to address this progress monitoring, we use progress monitoring measures to address some of these questions, to address what make eligibility and special ed eligibility and placement decisions, teachers and administrators and team, as a team, uses a lot of different pieces of information, including progress monitoring data, informal assessments, standardized assessments, to really make that high stakes decision. And the family, how is my child doing and how can we help to support my child's literacy development at home? And this is something I always ask when my child brings a weekly spelling test at home. Is he like following the instruction? Is he getting what's being taught? So it's really, it's not a, it's very specific teacher-made test, but it really informs the parents, like what's going on in classroom and what are my child learning and how is it learning. So when you're creating, so we talked about different users and different types of decisions that different users make. And so it can be really complicated when we think about like all these small pieces. So we recommend that you really need to plan first when you school districts are putting together a system of early literacy assessment. We really need to plan. What are the questions that we want to answer? What are the decisions that we need to make? And what assessment or what types of assessment score can address those questions specifically? And then we have to collect data, evidence accordingly. So it's not just like data collection or assessment happens like haphazardly, or you just like assess because it's whatever the school asks you to assess. You really need to plan ahead and really think through what kind of assessment has the evidence to support making that decision, and then assess accordingly. And then make decisions. So it becomes much easier if you already plan ahead. One thing to note is that some assessment tools provide multiple pieces of information or multiple types of scores, multiple data points. One example is the NWEA MAP growth assessments. So when students are administered a test, teachers receive a long list of scores, which includes overall our IT scores that's composed of foundational skills, language and writing, literature, informational, vocabulary use and functions. And also they get scores for Lexiles and focus skill, a list of focus skills that the students need to focus on. And all these different types pieces of information serve different purposes. So we cannot use, pick one and just use it for everything. For example, overall, our IT score can be used to address which student needs supplemental tier two instruction for screening purposes. Also, it can be used to make track progress, student progress. These subscales can be used, subscale scores can be used to identify then which specific skills does a student need support with. Lexile, it can be helpful to determine like the level of books that students can read independently. But Lexile cannot be used to monitor progress because it's not meant for that. There's no evidence to support that Lexile can be used to monitor progress, and it's sensitive enough to capture students' growth. Also, the list of focus skills, we cannot really use that to really determine the next instructional content that the student needs. There's not enough evidence to support the use of those list of skills in making instructional decisions. Okay, and I am going to hand over to Dr. Adria Trucker-Miller to talk about the technical adequacy.
Thanks, Ensu. Hopefully I can drum up a little bit of excitement about technical adequacy as next door, because it sounds like they're having a really great time next door. So I will attempt to put on my excitement about reliability. All right, so as Ensu pointed out, we have lots of different people around schools and hanging around schools that have to make really important decisions for improving outcomes in literacy, and they're making very different decisions. And the next component of when they're making those specific decisions, they need to have data to back them up so that they can feel comfortable saying, yes, I'm making this decision with this particular data point because I have this evidence saying that it can be used that way. And what's really hard, at least I find it very hard because I call a lot of assessment vendors asking them for this information because they don't have it on their website, they don't have it in an easily accessible place. When I get somebody on the phone, it's usually a salesperson who says, nobody's ever asked me for this information before, I don't know where it is, do you really need? Oh, good! I'm glad. Oh, all right, we have an NWEA person in the room, great. You guys did give them to us, so thank you, because we wanted to make sure we were right on that stuff, so we did look those up very closely, so.
Now it's more lively, right?
Yes it is. You can keep that up, by the way. Keep going through this, okay? All right, so a lot of times I get, when I'm working with teams, people are saying, I don't know if I can trust this data point. Well, yes, that's a great question to ask. Can you trust this data point? And the cool thing about these types of questions is we have quantifiable information that can tell us how much we can trust different data points. And those quantifiable pieces of information are defined in categories of reliability, validity, and fairness. And when we hear the words reliability and validity, we often have different definitions in our minds, and it takes a little bit of practice and comfortableness to work through these. And it's okay to have your definitions of reliability and validity in front of you on a cheat sheet. And we tried to make the guide to be a cheat sheet for you in terms of reliability and validity, and then also provide some resources in where you can find more updated reliability and validity and fairness information as it continues to be updated, because we know people are always doing studies on their assessment systems to further improve reliability and validity and fairness. Fairness also could be referred to as bias. So there's some people who use the term bias. So diving way into the weeds, but is one of my favorite topics, every single assessment, no matter what assessment you're using, whether it's a state achievement test all the way to an informal assessment that a teacher is using one-on-one with a student they know very, very well, all of these assessment points, data points, have some error associated with it. And something I encounter frequently is people coming up and saying, oh, I don't trust this data point because it's been wrong for these three kids, and tell me the story about the three kids that it's been wrong for. And yes, you better have kids that the data point is incorrect for. No assessment point is correct 100% of the time. It does not exist, and it will never exist. We can't get better at our assessment until it has 100% free from error. It just won't happen because we can't see inside the kid's head, and we can't, you know, accurately gauge what they're thinking. So we have this general construct of true ability that we're really trying to get at with our assessment. But what that, but when we measure a student, the score that we get does represent some version of their true ability, but it also has error. And then what's cool about the error is we can quantitatively measure the error through our research studies. And error is divided into two types of error. There's random error that we absolutely can't predict, and then there's systematic error that could be due to things we do know about that predict some of the problems. And so that random error that we can't predict, that's quantified as reliability. That systematic error that we can predict is what would be termed validity. So I'm not going to go too deep into reliability and validity because I think I'm in a room of people who know a little bit about reliability and validity. But in case you need a little thing that's been effective, at least that I've used for my teacher educators at Michigan State, and NSU has as well, is trying to help them understand why reliability in particular is so important. Often we have a lot of people who say, you know, they're very interested in validity. I want to know, does this assessment point measure what it says it measures? That's really important. But we can't get to that systematic error until we've dealt with reliability. And so for me, the first thing I look at on any assessment is its reliability. And that's the first place I'm looking at. What reliability is doing is really measuring how consistent this score is for this particular child at this particular time. So if I was to give this same assessment under the same exact conditions at the same time, would I get the same score? So reliability is really important. And a way you can demonstrate why reliability is very important is using something like this archer's target. If you took archery in middle school gym class, that was me, I don't know if anybody else did, we were trained first how to get more reliable in our shooting. So it was trying to hit, maybe it wasn't the middle of the target, but at least trying to get all of our shots grouped together in the similar place. Because if you are shooting all over the place, like this target right here, yeah, you may have hit the target once, so indicating some type of validity, measuring what you think you're measuring. You aren't frequently doing that. But if we can get reliable first, get used to hitting at the same spot at the same time, then we can adjust systematic error easily because it's predictable. So we can move it more towards the target. So with using like archery, for example, maybe you just move the sight on your bow so that it's more to the right to move your shot. So this is why reliability is important. Also, we know mathematically, reliability is a necessary but not sufficient condition to have validity. Okay, so for validity, this is the question we're all trying to get at. Does this assessment measure what it claims to be measuring? And what's really, really, really important, again, pointing back to what NSU was talking about planning first. So instead of having your data first, which I know happens a lot because we don't have much time in schools, so we come into a school or to a team meeting and we're shown data without thinking about what our question is first, this is where it becomes really important. If we don't have the question or the decision first, we're highly likely to make an invalid interpretation, because we haven't started out with what is the decision that we're aiming towards. I know for me, I get super distracted and I'm like, ooh, pretty graphs. What can I do with this information? So it's really important to start first. And what I do in team meetings is I'll put the question on the board or have it on the top, I'll print it on the top of reports about what specific data point we're using and what question we're using that to answer. I'll even put different data points on different pages. So I'll move to a different page and have the question at the top of the next page with the next data point there, so that we're using it very carefully, making sure that we're only using the data point for the question that it was validated for. Now here's where we got to get even more into the weeds and have a lot more assessment literacy somewhere in the room about what is an appropriate level of validity and who had the time to go check the technical manual on this. So then the third step. So we talked very quickly about reliability. We talked a little bit about validity. And as I was saying about those, the numbers on reliability and validity, we can quantify them. In the guidance document, we list those levels of reliability and validity for different types of decisions. So you'll have that easily at your fingertips, where you can double check kind of the levels of reliability and validity that you want to have for each different type of decision. The third piece we have a little bit less data on, but it does exist, is fairness or bias. So when you're first selecting your assessments, you're going through, I think Jim talked about having an inventory of your assessments that you have at your school and making sure you're carefully selecting what stays and what goes, or when you need to get a new assessment. So something that you want to look at for fairness is look if there are documentation for that assessment study, that there's some type of fairness considered. And there's two ways you can do that. One is looking at the demographics in the norm sample for particularly any assessment that does have a norm sample with it. You'll want to make sure that the demographics at least represent the groups that are in your school. Furthermore, there is a statistical technique called differential item functioning, DIF analysis, that looks at, do these items perform differently for different demographic groups? And not all assessments have done this, but many have. And I think as a general public, we can kind of demand more people to do these studies to give us a little bit more confidence that the items are or are not biased, because we're really biased looking at items too. There's been a famous study done several decades ago now where they had people look at items and try to identify which items are biased. And the people who looked at the items were correct in that some of the items were biased, but they weren't able to accurately tell which ones. And so I think we all have that, right? We're not really sure which items are biased, but we can use our statistical analyses to find that out. Also, of course, what's been reiterated over and over again is when you're making higher stakes decisions, you need more than one data point. You absolutely cannot make a good decision without multiple data points. So I love this graphic that Linda put together. I'm so glad she's in the room. She really makes information pop about thinking about different decisions that we're making. We have to think about the stakes for the decision. The data is only as valid as the consequences of the decision that's made. So we, of course, know we have lots of high-stakes decisions in schools, like placement into special education. That means the student is going to be placed in a different setting, have a different trajectory. So that's a high-stakes potential consequence, whether it be a positive consequence or a negative consequence. We have some moderate-stakes decisions, placing a student in a supplemental intervention. We do that a lot in middle school, where we'll put them in an extra reading class. And that decision is a moderate stakes one because, yes, it puts them in a different class, but it can be easily reversed if we find out we made a mistake with that decision. We can just change their schedule and put them into another class. So with our high stakes decisions, we want lots of data points to support that decision. Moderate stakes, we need a few, maybe. And then lower stakes decisions, like day-to-day instructional decisions that teachers are making in classrooms, we probably don't need really intensive reliability, validity data there. So one thing I find is sometimes having administrators ask teachers to use higher reliability, higher validity data in their day-to-day decision-making, they don't necessarily need to do that. How can we find some of this information? So in the guide, we point to some sites that keep updating their information. And one of those that I find really helpful and I use a lot in my work is the National Center on Intensive Intervention. Has anybody been to the National Center on Intensive Intervention website? Excellent. Oh, that's great. I love that they keep updating it too. Actually, since I put this graphic in this slide, it's been updated again. And they're also very open to feedback because I found it not super easy to use. But I have a good friend at AIR who's responsible for this, and she's really open to feedback and making it better. So please, you should also feel free to send them information asking them to update it. What's really nice is they have a tab called Technical Standards, and they list all of the assessment tools that are out there that have submitted information to AIR to review. And then they indicate the reliability and the validity according to the same standards that we put in our guidance document. Although our guidance document is going to stay static, so if the standards change, this website would be a good place to go find that. They also update if the bias analysis or the fairness or DIF has been conducted. And what's really nice you can see here is, yes, there has been some bias analyses conducted on some of these assessments that are out there. So that's where they cover those. Okay, finally, we're gonna move into content. The content of the assessment needs to be a valid measure of that specific content that we need. What I find difficult about content of assessment is we're trained to say, okay, we have to meet the standards. And so we often try to make this bridge and say, does this assessment measure every single standard for this particular grade level? And they don't, and we don't want them to, actually, right? Because we know that instruction and assessment, while they're aligned, they're a little bit different. So we have slightly different, not different content, but just a different way to group and how we think about the content that's on an assessment. So when we're thinking about reading, what do we want to measure in an assessment of reading? Fluency? Comprehension. Most teachers say, does my student comprehend what they're reading? That's usually what we're asking about. And so, yeah, reading comprehension is what we most measure at the largest domain, right? Because the ultimate goal of teaching children is to get them to be able to comprehend what they read. And of course, we have lots of high stakes assessments out there that will measure reading comprehension. However, in our earlier grades, kids can't read yet, so we don't expect them to be able to comprehend, so we can't measure reading comprehension directly. And so that was pointed out, let's measure fluency, oral reading fluency, or some other subsection of oral reading fluency, which I'll talk about in a second. This is not a measure of reading comprehension, but we know for certain grade levels that it's a good predictor of future reading comprehension. And so we will use that as a proxy for making these larger level decisions. So Ansu talked about leadership teams, administrators, policymakers, families looking for good schools, that will look at this larger grain size. However, if you give a reading comprehension score, let's say like you did the NWEA RIT score and you gave it to a teacher, she would say, yeah, I already know who in my class is struggling with reading. This information is not helpful to me. And she would be right. That information is not helpful for her. But that information is not for her specific decisions she needs to make, particularly. What she wants to know is, what do my students need? Now that I know, or now that the principal knows, that we need supplemental instruction for 5 students in my class, or 10 students in my class are below the benchmark, we need to do something about the curriculum or some other larger scale thing, then she needs to know what she needs to work on with those students. And our research to date shows that these fall into 2 broad categories, or areas that teachers might need more information about students so that they can pick a standard protocol tier 2 intervention program. So there's lots of great intervention programs out there that will have an impact specifically if the student's struggling in decoding. Here's a decoding intervention, a 14-week decoding intervention package that has impact on the components of this larger grain, overall reading, that will help the student improve their learning in decoding, which will then eventually affect the larger grain size, the reading comprehension. We also know we have certain subsets of students who struggle with one or both of decoding and language comprehension. So we might need some specific scores on language comprehension. And in the guide, we just provided a couple of concrete examples. This is not an exhaustive list of the assessment tools that will do that. We weren't trying to privilege anything that was any assessment tool that was out there. We just looked at tools that schools in Michigan use, as well as ones that are out there across the country that we know had good technical adequacy for some of these areas. And then once you have that level of information, that's still not super helpful for teachers moving their students day to day to the next piece of domain that they need to learn. So we need a finer grain of content to be represented in more informal assessments, some formative assessments, or reading specialists. When they get the toughest kids, they're going to dive really deep to really figure out which prerequisite skills did this student just not get so that I can move this student along. And they're looking really closely at the finer pieces of reading that we know predicts later reading. And they kind of fall in these 2 categories. And these are really hard to find reliable and valid assessments of. These are also the things that take a lot of time and expertise to administer. I have a lot of friends who are speech and language pathologists, and I'm a school psychologist, so I'm used to administering some of these. I've had to have specific training to administer some of the diagnostic assessments, right? Like the Woodcock-Johnson or the clinical evaluation of language functions. They're also very expensive to buy all the reproducibles, and they take a lot of time for the students. So we want to be very particular in who we're doing this fine-grained assessment with. We wouldn't necessarily take every single student in our class and administer the Peabody picture vocabulary test to determine their vocabulary, right? But for a student that we're really not sure what's going on in a standard protocol intervention that was aimed towards their oral and written language comprehension wasn't working, we would want to get that information. Is it their vocabulary? Is it their knowledge of sentence structure or text structure that we could really help with? Is it inference making or strategy use? Now you'll see that this is a very basic graphic breaking down some of the domains that we know to be good predictors of later reading achievement. we didn't include everything in the world on here, right? It takes textbooks to talk about the development of reading, especially in the early age range. So what we did is we picked areas that we know for sure have been demonstrated in extensive research studies. Some of these research studies that I've been involved in Florida that have been funded by the Institute for Education Sciences, where by combining these measures, we're predicting about over 95% of the variance in reading comprehension. So we know a lot of these are really high leverage places that if we can impact these specific skills, that we can make the biggest impact on their development and closing that gap. So there are some things that are missing. And clearly other things, you know, if these are all fine for a student, you would want to consider other aspects. But we just highlighted these because they're predictive, number one, and malleable, number two, meaning we can actually impact them in the school. Of course, we know things like socioeconomic status are a huge predictor of kids' reading outcomes. Unless we're going to move that child to another neighborhood and get that parent an influx of cash, we can't change their socioeconomic status. But we can change things that we have control over, which is instruction in the school, in the classroom. So that's why we're focusing specifically on those things, because our goal, our number one goal, is to move that child's achievement. Because that's the one thing we can do to maybe improve their socioeconomic status down the road. All right, so like I said, these are, we want different domains for sizes for different decisions. These are the same decisions that Ensu had up earlier, where we want our leadership to be asking questions and making the decisions that need the larger grain size. Whereas teachers or interventionists are asking questions like, how do I group my students? And what supplemental instruction do these particular students need? And then, of course, teachers day-to-day need to know these finer-grained pieces. And some of these are really nice. You can get them out of the standards. There's a really nice document, for example, by the Center on Instruction that breaks down the kindergarten through five foundational literacy skills, breaks it down into the sub-skills that are needed to perform well in each of those standards. And it's in these areas, and they do a really nice job using the research to inform the progression that kids need. Yeah.
What was that website?
The Center on Instruction. Thanks for asking. I don't think we put that in the document. We can definitely add it. Well, really? Okay. Thanks for asking about that, yeah. And I think the REL Southeast has a document for it as well. All right, so that's a lot of different components to pull together and a lot of different facets that we have to keep in mind when we're thinking through selecting assessments and specifically data points that we're using. We want to make sure we're aligning the right person to the right decision, to the right level of technical adequacy, to the right content. That's a lot to ask for. We tried to provide in the document a couple of solid examples, and you can find this in section 4, principle 4 of section 3, where we go through various types of tier 1 decisions, various types of tier 2 decisions, and tier 3 decisions. So I'm just gonna highlight one of the tier 2 decisions that are made. One of them that I talked about quite a bit is teachers get their screening data and are told to do something with the data, and they say, I don't know what to do with this data, it's not giving me the information I want, right? What they really want to know is, what primary components of literacy do these students who are found to be at risk, what do they need? And so they need some type of assessment that provides information about students' strengths and weaknesses in their knowledge relative to some of these subcomponents of reading. Some interim assessment tools will provide this information alongside with the screening data. Some, but not all. Sometimes you might have to use a different tool altogether. What was really neat is these were illustrated in the portraits with the decision that was made and then the learning gains that were also made based on those pieces. For this type of moderate stakes decision, this is not a high stakes decision, but then again, putting them in an intervention group's not a low stakes decision either, because they might be missing other content that's presented in the classroom. So we do need some level of technical adequacy for this type of decision. And the recommendations right now that a consensus of the field has is that you should have a reliability above 0.6 in that technical manual for making these types of decisions. Also, a validity above 0.6. So validity meaning this is an assessment of decoding, if it says it's an assessment of decoding, or this is an assessment of language, if it says it's an assessment of language. And you get this 0.6 by having a research study where they've administered this assessment, let's say vocabulary assessment. They've administered that at the same time as something like the PPVT, the Peabody Picture Vocabulary Test, which we know definitely measures vocabulary. So does it correlate with the PPVT at 0.6? Then we know, yep, this is probably a measure of vocabulary. And then we have the users of this information. So clearly, teachers really want this information. It might not be as useful to others in the school who are also making important decisions. So you see how we kind of tied all of those together. How am I doing on time, guys? Oh, 10 minutes, okay. All right. So does anybody have any questions about this before I move on, tying these pieces together? All right, I wanted to circle around, gonna wrap up with some misconceptions that we've seen based on our practice, as well as some key takeaways for this whole tying users to decisions to technical adequacy to content. And one of the things we see a lot with data is using grade levels. And we find that colloquially and in the general public, these are really helpful in terms of talking to parents, and they're understandable to people. People are used to talking about, is my student on grade level or below grade level? And it's easy to understand. Unfortunately, we often use grade level information that's provided by assessment in ways they weren't designed for, or ways that we don't have any evidence to support. And I'm gonna put up here, well, I've put up here three ways that we don't have any evidence to support them being used. And I feel relatively confident in this because in our principal contributor group, Brandy really put together very well a group of people who know the literature very well and have scoured it pretty deeply. And none of us have been able to find any support for using grade levels in this way. So sometimes we'll get an assessment that says, this student is at a level D, which corresponds to end of first grade. And this student should be at a level G, but they're not. So we need them to move four levels in order to be on grade level. I would challenge anybody in this room, if you find the data that supports this, please tell me that you can say this student is 2 years below grade level, or this student moved from D to G, so they made two grade levels worth of growth. Or I have, in my class, I have five students who are level D, six students who are level E, seven students who are level F. So that's how I'm gonna group my students for small group instruction in reading. None of these really have support for the decisions that we're making. So I would encourage you to take on that difficult conversation with your folks who are using this kind of information and help them find the information they really need, which is to say if their student is growing, because we do have data that will tell you if the how much the student has grown. Unfortunately, it's not intuitive and it's harder to describe to parents. We can't say your child has made 2 years worth of growth because nobody can. tell you that. We just don't know how to tell you that piece of information. So I think that's a hard conversation. And then also levels can provide some information, like Ensu talked about earlier, that it can tell you what text will be more or less difficult for a child to read. And this is important for one thing, independent reading. If the child's going to read by themselves, we better make sure it's text they can read. And personally, what I do is I just pull a book off the shelf that they're really interested in, and I have them read the first page. And if they make more than two or three mistakes, then it's going to be too hard for them. So we can do that in a really informal, easy way. And we should really encourage them, even if it is hard, if they're super interested in reading it, have them read with a buddy or do something to support them engaging in text that is too hard for them, but is interesting. All right, so our key takeaways for pulling all of these pieces of information together, make sure we're using multiple sources of information when making decisions. So that includes both formal and informal pieces of data for high-stakes decisions. The level of evidence that we need, so these reliability metrics and these validity metrics, they might be very different for the lower-stakes decisions versus the higher-stakes decisions. And so right now, here are our reliability levels that we need for different types of decisions. And then here's the type of validity that we need. So there's different types of validity that are reported out there. And you'll find in our glossary, we define each of these types of validity. We may be more or less successful in making that vocabulary accessible to people, but it is all in there. So before I move on back to Jim or Brandy is doing.
I have something for everybody.
So. Well, there's a couple more slides. I think this is Jim's slide. No?
Well, it was just, I wanted people to sort of see some of the implementation recommendations, just to indicate, because I put up a big slide that had unreadable because it had all of the stuff in there.
Okay, so before I turn it over to Jim to wrap up, to bring back to the broader piece of the report, I want to see if anybody had any specific questions, because we went through some challenging things. Yeah, go ahead.
The thing you were saying about letter levels and that, well, one particular system that's used quite a bit in the state. I think the missing piece with that is that letter leveling system is intended to be used for instructive purposes. So it's usually the stuff that's still wrapped in the cellophane around text features that go with those letter levels, and that intent behind that particular one that I think is swing at, probably 9 times out of 10, that's what everybody's using. That's what it's designed for. So it's not designed to make a claim about using
it. I'm so glad you brought that up. So the key thing that we think is happening with the text, with the leveling, with the letter leveling system, is they're measuring text. And that's a key differentiation, is that the measurement is of text, and we're trying to measure a student's skill. And so those are two different things. We're more or less accurate at measuring text, right? People have been trying to measure readability for decades and decades and decades. And while it's gotten better, it's still not the same as measuring the kids' abilities. It can remain unnamed. We know what you're talking about.
The text leveling system, it is the characteristics of the text. It's a confined ecosystem, so it's not like, it's not bad. I'm not saying it's bad. I'm just saying. Like,
but it's a level D relative to the other text in their system.
And the narrative D and the informational D, the point is, here are the instructive points. You don't act on those instructive points related to those text features. That's the theory of action that goes with that particular program. And so if you're not seeing it in that way, then you may need to make some other misguided judgments about it in a past life. I'm just trying to help this down. So it's just a lot of work. Lots of ways we like to level reading.
Yeah,
Eric. I have a list. It's up to 79.
Are you going to share it?
No.
Okay.
Please check out his website. Thank you so much for sharing that. All right.
I know we've thrown a lot at you, covered a lot. Hopefully what you get a sense of is in the report, not only have we tried to sort of lay out the big ideas, but then some of the important things to back that up in terms of these very specific discussions about users and uses and the technical adequacy, all of which you have to take into account when you're thinking about the elements of this system that you're going to put into place and who's going to use it. So the last thing I wanted to just point out is that, as I said earlier today, in addition to laying out these five principles, we tried to lay out sets of recommendations that districts and district leadership teams can try to follow in order to start to put in place such a system. So for example, in this phase two, which is the implementation, we talk about a leadership team using a logic model and theory of action to guide the selection and implementation of assessment tools and resources. And two of the specific recommendations, notice it says the team should work in conjunction with principals and teachers, and they essentially follow the idea that they need to select resources on the basis of evidence of appropriate levels of technical adequacy, and emphasizing again the difference between high stakes judgments and lower stakes judgments. And another important point about this, and I think it's alluded to in the points that have been made in the questions, that part of what this team needs to do is to provide assistance and guidance to the system's users in terms of helping assure that they can select assessments that are going to fulfill their needs, but then also use them in technically appropriate ways, in valid ways. So it is a lot of educating about assessment of literacy, among the many things that have to go into putting this system together. It isn't just a collection of assessments, it is a principled way of putting the pieces together. And so I would point out the executive summary for the report is here, and inside is a lovely layout that has the phases and the print and the recommendations. I encourage you to read the report, use the report, provide feedback to us. The interesting thing about the issue of the resources is, I think on the MAC website, we're going to provide that, and that's going to be a living list, so that as new resources get discovered or uncovered, they can be added to the list, and people can point out to us and to MAC what resources they've found. So that the idea is that this isn't just a static entity, it actually has an ongoing life in terms of what we learn from people trying to use it. I think there's a couple more slides. It just says there's a bunch of references too.
We are academics after all. Lots and lots of thanks to Ensu and Adria and Jim for the presentation. And you all look like a lovely group of people who care really deeply about assessment in Michigan. And so my plea for you is to not only take one of the executive summary, whatever this is, this important paper. What is this? Oh, it's about our session. Take one of those. And most importantly, because you care so much about assessment in Michigan, please take one of these little surveys and give us some feedback. It will help us know where to go next with this assessment guidance for early literacy. So that's my plea. I'll actually bring them around to you because, you know. But if you would like an executive summary or the summary of our presentation, they're here too. Thank you so much. Enjoy your next session.